I'm Ethan Sharp. I'm here in Lexington, Kentucky. Today is October 27th, 2020. And Talisha, would you introduce yourself?
Yes, my name is Talisha Wilson from Louisville, Kentucky.
Okay. So to get us started, Talisha, could you tell us a little bit about your background, where you grew up, where you went to school, and some things you've been working on over the past few years?
Like I said, my name is Talisha Wilson. I am born and raised Louisville, Kentucky, West End. I've lived in the West End pretty much my whole entire life, besides a few times like in Shively, and then also when I went to U of L. I went to Central High School, which is a historical black school here in Louisville, Kentucky. It's where Muhammad Ali went to school, so very proud of that. Before 2020, I was working on Diversity at the Table, which is my organization that talks about the intersections between gender, race, class, and sexuality, and how all those things relate to social issues that we encounter on a regular basis. In addition to that, I was focusing on bringing into my modeling and makeup social justice. With me being a fat body, it's very important for me to find clothes that fit good and make me feel good. And then, of course, with makeup, finding makeup for dark skinned black women has always been a challenge. So, kind of like fighting against those systems that even like white supremacy projects onto the fashion and makeup industry. I was focusing on that. And then I was also doing a lot of community stuff. I was working with and still am working with Ideas X Lab, and on a project called Our Emotional Well-Being. We were working with LGBTQ youth and some other youth from Mazeek Middle School, where we were focusing on emotional health and the well-being of youth and where that comes from, and kind of how we manifest those things, and what is hope and what is belonging. And we kind of talked about hope being this thing that people seek out, this confidence, or this thing that people visualize, and that even hope within itself is attached to many privileges. I can't hope for something if I can't visualize it. And a lot of people can't visualize those things if they don't know that it exists. So we talked about those type of things. When I was in college, I was an LGBTQ ambassador. That basically meant that I went, not went, but I was someone who had been on the campus for a few years. So when you have newcomer freshmen and LGBTQ freshmen, they could come to the LGBTQ office, get assistance from other LGBTQ students, whether that is, maybe taking them, going with them to get their first tee shot, or maybe it is suggesting safe spaces, helping them find housing, helping them navigate through tough conversations when they go back home to their families during the holidays. I also was a part of the inclusion and equity program. That's where I got my facilitation training the most, and my diversity training, how to navigate these very difficult conversations. And then I was the event coordinator for Empowering Ladies Together, which is an organization that did exactly that, Empowered Ladies Together, kind of brought about different events on campus that was focused around the empowerment of all women, specifically black women and other marginalized women, and people, not just women, but people. That's kind of where my background comes from. And then, of course, like doing a lot of working, doing some facilitation for JCPS teachers, students. I think I went to Shawnee before. We did a professional development, all of those different type of things, going to different conferences. I went to the White Privilege Conference. I went to the Create and Change conference. Learned a lot of things, made many connections, sat on many panels. So that's kind of where my background
And
is.
that was
Community engagement.
in the previous years, right? Not, you know,
Yes,
in 20,
in
okay.
the previous years.
Yeah, could you talk a little bit more about diversity at the table? You know, I think that might be a kind of a good place to jump into 2020. You know, what are some issues you talked about in diversity at the table, and how was the way you approached them different than, you know, how other people, you know, how other who don't have that concept of intersectionality sort of in the forefront, how was it different for you?
So like I said, diversity at the table is about gender, race, class, and sexuality, and how all of those things relate to everyday things, like literally everyday things. Me sitting at home and watching my television and seeing an advertisement that doesn't represent me, or an advertisement that over-sexualizes women, or we're talking about those things. What I wanted to do was bridge that gap between campus and community. There was a lot of things that I was learning in college, and I know that going to college is a privilege. It's not something that everyone is able to do, even though everyone is deserving to further their education. So I wanted to take those things back into my community and share them with folks who needed it, but communicated it in a way to where it wasn't intimidating, right? So we would do activities and stuff. So for one of my activities, we would like go around the room and put different it'll be I don't know, different poster pads around the room would say certain things like black man, black woman, white man, white woman, homeless, transgender, wealthy, all of those things. And people will have to come into the room and put their very first initial reaction to the word. And that way we can deconstruct those biases that we have. But what that does is once you go around the room so many times, there's so many different people, and you pull that sheet that says homeless, and you read some of the things that people have written, and it's like bum, dirty, don't have no money, always can I have a dollar? It was all of these things, right? So what we learned in the room is that we too have biases about people, you know what I mean? And where do these biases come from? And what are some reasons why you can be homeless? Is it because people just simply are lazy, or is it because some people are veterans, or it's a recession and people don't have jobs and have been laid off, and people have mental health issues that have not been addressed. People have drug addictions, and that is a disease, you know? So there's not just this influx of people who are just lazy and just dirty and all those things. So making sure that we navigate those conversations and talk about that. So that's the way that I pull people in who don't have this knowledge. We pull them in by making them participate in these opportunities, or making them participate in these activities that center around microaggressions, our biases, discrimination, and prejudices, and people start reflecting on their own. And then I can start with the heavy stuff of like gender and how it's a social construct, and how it's not something that, we have to, that is so binary, right? So that's kind of how diversity at the table even started, like.
That sounds awesome. Well, let's jump into 2020 then. So I don't know if you would if you want to talk a little bit about the pandemic and how that affected you, you know, going back to sort of the beginning of the year. I don't know if diversity at the table was interrupted by that or anything else that you're working on, or you know, how that if we could sort of start there, and then we'll, you know, sort of move from there.
So diversity at the table, so like I said, it was started because it was a safe space for people to come and be exactly who they are. And that meant, bringing all parts of themselves and being unapologetic about it. So it just became a safe space for people to just express. Diversity at the table stopped for many reasons. It was interrupted for many reasons. A lot of that was my own mental health that I needed to take care of. There was a lot of inconsistencies with my meetup times and stuff, because I was also dealing with many things, relationships. I was also dealing with finding myself in navigating between being this person who is really really embedded in the community and want to work for my community, but still needing to take care of bills and live my life because I'm an adult now. So having to navigate corporate America and community was very difficult to and very draining to my mental health. So that was part of the reason. And then the other reason was because of COVID.
Yeah.
And now buildings are beginning to close and we don't have a consistent place to meet, or we're having to minimize the amount of people who can come. And that's very difficult.
Yeah.
Because how do you get to choose? How do you pick and choose who can come?
Yeah. Yeah.
This is a free event for the whole entire community. People are not obligated to be in this space.
Yeah.
So how do you, you know, determine who gets to show up and who you turn away?
Right.
So that was hard to navigate.
Right.
So that was that on that. And then also with the pandemic, it kind of like also increased my depression. It made me, you know, really, it was a very dark time.
Before
this stuff happened with Breonna Taylor.
Yeah.
It still is within that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I know 2020 has been such a, I mean, there's been so much that's happened this year. So maybe we could start sort of talking about how you learned about the murder of Breonna Taylor and, you know, what, because, you know, I know the movement started slowly. So I don't know how, you know, where you came in on that. So if you can just sort of walk us through all of that.
Yeah. One of the first times that I heard about Breonna Taylor was actually not about Breonna Taylor. It was more so about Kenneth Walker.
Yeah.
There was somebody on my timeline on Facebook who kept saying, like, what about Kenneth? You know what I'm saying? He done got locked up and he don't deserve to get locked up. Free Kenneth, free Kenneth, free Kenneth. Mm-hmm. He didn't deserve to get locked up. He was protecting his girlfriend. So mm-hmm. I kept hearing that and I kept reading that from friends on my Facebook. So I was looking into the story and, but at that time I was also very desensitized to what was going on, right? As a person who's been doing social justice for over 10 years, at some point, over the 10 years, and especially in the last, like maybe 2 to 3 years, it has become very draining. People send you articles every day. People send you videos every day of people being murdered. You're always hearing about these, police brutality. This police shot this person. This freedom fighter was found here. This freedom fighter, committed suicide. This person died from a heartache and, Eric Gardner's daughter dying. It was a lot. It was overwhelming.
Yeah.
So even though I heard about this story and knew that something is happening and something is going on and something is wrong, right? So Kenneth Walker was just a familiar face for me because we didn't go to the same school with each other, but we lived in the same neighborhood. So that meant that we rode the same compound bus to get to the buses that took us to school.
Yeah.
So I knew him from that. But other than that, I didn't really know him. So we kind of just, he was a familiar face.
Right.
So I knew that something was going on and something was wrong, but I wasn't diving into it the way that I should have, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't until that Thursday that we first started protesting. My ex-girlfriend wrote me and was kind of just like, you know, hey, I know that you've been taking a break and you've been fighting social justice in a different way. But, you know, one of the talking about Chanel, who is the co-founder of Black Lives Matter Louisville.
Mm-hmm.
She said Chanel really, really needs you down there. Like, there's a lot of people down there and they don't know organizing the way that you know organizing.
Yeah.
They don't know protest the way that you know protesting. She might need you down there to help her organize these people so that we can be out here fighting for justice. And I'm just like, wow. So at this point, I was at home with my friends and we were eating food and I was just like, you know, y'all, let's just get up and go.
Uh-huh.
And let me prepare y'all. It's going to be a little crazy, but it is an out-of-body experience. And we went down there and it was something I had never seen before. People were angry for so many different reasons.
Yeah.
You know, people didn't have jobs.
Yeah.
People were not being taken care of. of in the medical field as it pertains to COVID.
Yeah.
We felt lied to by the government. We felt enclosed in our homes for months. And also George Floyd died, and Ahmaud Arbery died, and Breonna Taylor died. People were upset and angry and just were crying. Basically, like within all of the anger, what I saw, it was people who were just upset. People were angry. And I too was angry. And that anger was fueled by those other people. And I was like, dang, like, people are really affected by this. So that's how it kind of started for me.
Do you remember around what time that was when you went down to that first protest?
I want to say it was maybe, let me look. I think that it was May 28th.
Yeah,
it was May 28th.
Yeah.
And I haven't been back to work since that day.
Yeah. Wow. So you were working another job and then you quit that? Is that? Okay. Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
I was working at a job and I took a leave of absence because for one, like, I can't return back to work during this time, it's literally impossible.
Yeah.
So the expectation of it is just like wrapped in white supremacy. And so I took a leave of absence because my mental health was really being affected. I was waking up, night terrors, sweats, crying, tears, unable to just focus. You know, besides only on this, people were blowing up my phone. What are we going to do next? And I had a focus. They needed me more than my corporate job did. And I took a leave of absence for mental health to get that together.
Okay.
But what I realized is that with my leave of absence, I just kept working for my community. And they kept loving me and they kept feeding me and they kept listening and we kept moving together and as a collective, and that's what I needed. And I had already been talking about wanting to quit my job for years. I've been saying I wanted to quit my job for 2.5 years before this even happened. And I wanted to work on my community. I wanted to focus on my community. I wanted to organize full time. So even though Breonna was a sacrifice that should have never been sacrificed, and what came out of that was a lot of transformation for so many people, so many organizations, so many people who we thought were fighting for us who was not, calling out so many different organizations and holding them accountable, calling out so many individuals, so many institutions, so many entities to hold them accountable. Gen Z has been showing up. I'm a millennial, but Gen Z really showing up and really fighting for their rights as well. It just was a transformative time for so many people. So after I realized that, I decided I'm not going back to work. I can't. I mentally can't do this. It's impossible.
Yeah, I was just curious because you didn't mention your job at first. But there was a few weeks, you know, since from the time Breonna was killed until, you know, that first big protest. Was there something during that time that really, you know, motivated people to get out? Was there one particular event, a news story or something that just really
So like the reason why Breonna Taylor was delayed, because there is still sexism that exists within the Black community, right? Sexism doesn't go away just because we share the same race. And so that's what happened. You know, Black women, when they die at the hands of police or deal with police brutality, their stories are not amplified in the capacity that it is for Black men. And that's why you know the names of Ahmaud Arbery and George Floyd before you knew the names of Breonna Taylor. You know what I mean? And that's why you only know about Sandra Bland and you don't know about, you know, Rakita Boyd, and you don't know about Atiana Jefferson. You don't know about Tatiana, you don't know about all of these other people. You don't know about Korean gangs. You don't know about the Black trans men and women who have died at protests or at the hands of police officers or at the hands of other Black people. You don't know about these things because sexism and homophobia and transphobia exist even within the Black community. So people did not move until George Floyd and Ahmaud Arbery were being fought for. And that's a problem. And that's what we want to amplify. And that's why we say her name versus saying his name. We don't say Saquon's name. His name has already been said. That's why you know who Trayvon Martin is, who Michael Brown is, who Eric Garner is, who Frank Gray is, who, you know, Tamir Rice is, who Amon Aubrey is, who George Floyd is, who Corey Boykin is. That's why you know all of these names. You know Emmett Till. You know all the names of the black men who have died at the hands of police. But now you are seeing that black women are too dying at the hands of police at the same rate, almost. So we need to amplify those voices as well, because without black women at the table, without black women organizing, without black women doing the work that we do, nobody gets justice anywhere. That means black women, black men, white men, heterosexual people, gay people. Without black women and black queer women and black trans women at the forefront of all of these movements, you don't get anything. So it was really because of other black men who died that Breonna Taylor's story was amplified, which is what we don't want to continue to happen. A black man shouldn't have died in order for people to know that my life matters.
And when you went to that first protest, women were at the forefront of it from the beginning, or was that something that can you talk about that a little bit?
So like, I know that women need to be at the forefront and younger folk, because I'm an organizer who's been organizing for years, but these people were people out here who were just angry. Yeah. So it was a lot of men. It was a lot of cisgender heterosexual men, which is fine. That doesn't mean that they can't lead, but it's about passing the mic, amplifying other voices as well. And I think that that's not something that they were privy to. They didn't know that information. They didn't understand it. They too are a part of a sexist society. So at first it was not that. And it hasn't always been that. It's, in some spaces, it's still, in some spaces, it still is not that. So, you know, I think that, like, over time, you try to teach that. It has been very difficult, but you try to teach them about centering other voices and not just the main voice that holds power in this space.
Was that a struggle, or was that something that sort of happened now?
Oh, that was definitely a struggle. That is still a struggle to this day. That will continue to be a struggle of making sure that people who have other oppressions fighting against them know that they still have privileges in other areas, right? It's very difficult to explain to poor white people that they still have white privilege. Yeah. It's hard to understand, I mean, or to explain to cisgender heterosexual black men that they still hold privilege. It's very difficult because they're like, I'm black or I'm poor. And it's like, yeah, you're discriminated because of your race, not because of your gender. You're discriminated because of your class and not your race. People don't understand that. And it's very hard to have that conversation when people are just now learning about intersectionality or they are just now hearing that term. So in this time is very difficult, but also very transformative, because people are, trainings have been happening. Direct action trainings have been going on for years. I've been to direct action trainings well before 2020. I was doing that in 2014, 2015, doing trainings and stuff, being on calls and doing interviews and stuff like that. That stuff was happening then. And it usually happens, the best time for it to happen is during the time where we call it downtime. Those are the best times for it to happen, because we're not having to fight for justice and train at the same time.
Was there a training?
We're being a little bit proactive.
I'm sorry, I was going to ask, was there a training session that was, can you talk a little bit about a training session that was really useful to you before 2020?
Well, I was doing a lot of trainings with BLM. Okay. So I was doing a lot of like meeting up every Sunday, talking with Chanel, organizing with people, even Kalala Collins, teaching, learning things from her, just having these. And when I say direct action training, it's not necessarily that we sat there and did, well, we did do some of that, but it was also these other things that existed. You had Green Dot training. That is really helpful to learn how to, you know, how to have conversations with people and how to deflect. Right. We were doing Diversity at the Table, where you're learning how to have these difficult conversations in all of the different spaces, whether it is with your family or your job. There's other events going on about LGBTQ people and their rights. all of these things were existing already, but people were not going to it. They didn't know, they didn't realize that these are the things that you would need today. So I've hosted a total of maybe a good 50 trainings over the last 153 days.
You did them now. You did them this in this year, 2020. Okay. Okay.
Yes. And that's probably a reach, probably like more so like 40. But and I even have one today, and I'm continuing to have them and have not stopped.
So from that first protest in May, what did you like get together with some folks to come up with a plan for next steps? You know, did you have sort of it?
So I saw people out. They weren't really listening on Thursday and Friday. You know, they were angry, which rightfully so. They were well deserving of that anger, and they just needed to express it. So I didn't really do anything on those 2 days. On Saturday, that Saturday after, which I think was the 30th, I decided to have a training.
Okay.
And it was a really quick training. It was more so just to give people a little bit of understanding of what needs to happen in order to keep people safe.
Okay.
So it was more so talking about the role of white people, the role of black men, what to do when certain things happen. The things that you should know before you even get to a protest. It was those type of things that we were learning, and I invited people out, and then afterwards we did an action. And I did that alone the first time, and then some people who were at the training, they helped organize an actual action that would take place later on that day. And then we invited folks, told folks to meet us places and all of that stuff, got people to, you know, get really tight with security culture so that people can remain safe, and getting people to think strategically about going out there and not just, okay, you're angry and that's valid and we want you to remain angry, but we also want you to do something with that anger that is going to progress us in a way progress us to change. And then after that, I just continue to host those trainings with myself, but now I am deciding to create a team so that I don't have to do that by myself, because it's a dream.
Was there a concern? As part of your training, did you talk to folks about being safe with the pandemic, you know, wearing masks and all that? I don't know, was that something?
Yes. So, yeah, definitely. So with all my trainings, anytime we do any action or anything like that, I make sure that every single person in my training is requires that on the flyer, it says wear a mask. Mm-hmm. And if you don't have a mask, one will be provided for you. There will be food. It's been in a space where we've been able to still social distance. And then also people are getting regular COVID tests. There are so many spaces where you are able to get free COVID testing. So we are encouraging people to do that, offering up those resources. Also a lot of healing things, encouraging people to drink tea and get your daily vitamins and stuff like that. So those things are too important. Some of my friends were hitting me up during this pandemic every now and again.
Yeah.
Did you eat?
Yeah.
Did you drink water?
Yeah.
Did you take your vitamins? Yeah. You know what I'm saying? Those are the things that, because it's not just about action. It's also about healing too. So we're doing all of those things. Anytime we go to any action, I make sure that everyone at my action who is there from my training anyway, or who is there when we meet up, that they have a mask on. Anytime I go to an action, I bring my mask with me. Just recently we thought that there was a police involved shooting here in Louisville. It wasn't, but we thought that it was. And so everyone mobilized. But I brought my thing of masks, because sometimes people just don't wear their masks, but we're still in the pandemic, right? I know that it's difficult. So I try to, you know, bring those masks down there so people can still remain safe and fight for social justice at the same time.
Can you talk about that first action, or any action that you know, you can tell us a little bit more about, you know, who came, what did you do, and, you know, what was the outcome of it?
Well, we went to Boerstown Road. That was the first action. That was the first protest
Okay.
that I facilitated or that I organized, and that was on Boerstown Road. And I did that alongside a few other people. And it was great. It was really good. We had a plan. Everyone knew the plan. Everyone knew the route that we were going. People knew where to jump in, where to jump out. They respected us. We all were on one accord. When things didn't go di when things went different or went sour, when things went different or went sour, we talked about it before we made a decision with one another. It was really, really good. People were really happy about it. The next day, people were writing about it. People were clapping about it. And I made sure that because people know me and because people know who I am, they were very much like focused on me. And I wanted people to be focused on the other organizers who helped me. So I made sure that people knew
Did
about
that one
that
have
too.
a goal, or was it more about making your presence known? And
Yes, it was more so about making our presence known. And then there was the action on the mayor where we
I saw
came from
that.
behind. So that was organized by me as well. And that one was planned out and that was really strategic, right? So we did that. But again, as you see, everybody walked up with masks on. You know, everyone had masks on. And so we did that one. That goal was just to interrupt space. We have to let the mayor know because gentrification is so closely connected to Black people not having freedom, Black people not having generational wealth, because it's so closely connected to that. Anytime where we wanted the mayor to know, it doesn't matter. You're not going to be able to just go about life just regularly without addressing what's happening around us. And then, of course, the big one in Nulu. And that one was really good and transformative because it was very art-based. Art is so important to this movement, and it really writes the story without the words. And so that was very beautiful, but that was very strategic too. We planned that out really well. So that's what really all of this is about, organizing. We can pretty much do whatever as long
Can you
as we
talk a little bit more
organize.
about the Nulu protests, and then how the art came into
Yeah,
it?
like so Nulu, we started with Nulu because during the uprising, Nulu is right down the street from where everything was going on at. And I guess there was fear of looting. Now let's keep in mind that looting only happened those first 2 days. But also I don't necessarily care about looting. Like people are angry, like and bodies over property. You know, you can make this over. We cannot re come back to life and live, right? It's of course like reincarnation and all of that stuff, but that's a whole different story, right? Essentially, we can't like after I die, I'm dead, right? So, property, people over property. So there was a lot of performative allyship going on where people were beginning to put Justice for Breonna Taylor in their windows so that we wouldn't hit those windows. Say her name so that we wouldn't go in those stores so we wouldn't loot it, right? And I understand wanting to protect your property, but also like you can actually just be a person who is an actual ally. You can be an actual ally. You don't have to pretend or perform allyship. You can actually be an ally. And that was making me very upset because Nulu is a neighborhood that has been gentrified. Nulu is a neighborhood where Black people used to live. And now we have white people and white business owners doing whatever they can to keep Black people away from it, even if that means being a performative ally, also that they can preserve this good old Nulu that the city loves so much. And how dare you? When we are grieving, and how dare you when we are sad and we are actually fearful of our lives? And how dare you when I have to go to the West End and have none of that? The West End is a food desert. The West End is a desert of all things. We have no boutiques. We have no shops. We have no big nice mom and pop juice bars and macaroon bars and bars and you know boutiques and coffee shops and bike stores. We don't have that down here at all. We are deserving. So like we decided, you know what, since you all are opening up soon, the bars and stuff, let's go down here because there's a lot of white people who are gonna come down here because they love this area and they want to drink, but they don't have to know this story about Breonna Taylor. They get to come down here in Nulu, not be interrupted, their space not be interrupted, their time not be interrupted, their life not be interrupted, and then they get to get right on the highway and go right to Crestwood or go right to Prospect or go right to St. Matthews and live their privileged life. They don't have to worry about this at all. And no, absolutely not. That does not get to happen. It's not okay. And so that's why we went out there, is because we needed to disrupt space. We needed to disrupt white space specifically. We needed to disrupt space that people that the city would be upset about. Nulu has a lot of investors that make up the city a lot of money. And we know that. And the city did not, the people in Nulu, and then also the city did not think that we were going to do the research that we did as it pertained to Nulu. They didn't know that we were not, they are afraid now. And they know that we are testing capitalism in a whole different way. They didn't think that we did our research. They thought that we were coming down there to be angry. They were so unaware of what we were doing. They didn't know what was happening. They didn't know that we had thought these things out and that we were being very strategic and that we had things mapped
And
and
so
planned out.
you marched down there, and what was the steps? I mean, I know that I've read some stuff, but I'd like for you to talk a little bit about what the action was.
Yeah, so like we decided to march down there. We decided to march, but then we also had people who were setting up art down there. And the art was to act
But
as
right in the street
barricades,
there,
but
right?
also to yeah, like it was on the side. So it was like, so it was many, there was a lot of art going on. There was art on each side of the block. So there was art on Clay Street, there was art on Shelby Street, but then there was art happening in the middle. And that's where you see that yellow table where like the police are gonna walk up and lock us up. As we're sitting here having a communal dinner, a communal event, it's art. People are sitting here with flowers, and you are going to pick us up and take us to jail. And you look horrible. You look so bad. You look horrible. And you look sad. And you look like terrorists. And that's the goal. And so, and that's what happened. And so exactly what we wanted to
And
achieve, we
did
achieved.
you do you have any speeches there, or was it more just the art and sitting down?
So we didn't have speeches, but we had like demands. We had things that we wanted the people to know. We had things that we wanted the business owners to know, and they were able to. We got the information to the business owners in Nulu. We sent emails, we dropped off letters, we have continued to meet with these business owners and hold conversations with them.
And I was going to ask something, but it just went out of my mind. Yeah. Oh, I was going to ask the artists. Who were some of the artists that were involved in that?
So there are so many I can't even name, but basically we have an art team, and the art team really is instrumental. They push out a lot of the art. And then also, it's not necessarily just an art team. There's an art team to help us execute, the ideas that we have. But it's just people who you don't have to be an artist to do those things. You can just paint some stuff. So again, the spaces that I create are not just about action, but it's also about healing. Right, it's also about healing too. So sometimes we just have these art spaces so that people can just stroke the brush and just
Were
work
you
their way out of that.
prepared that for arrest? Was that something you were anticipating when you did that?
So we prepare for everything. We don't ever go into an action like, let's get arrested because we're still in a global pandemic. Also, like, jails are not safe. And then they're not responding to COVID in the way that they should. So we're never wanting people to get arrested at all. But we do prepare for that. We do say, this is what a pop, this is a possibility. There's a possibility of this happening.
Right,
and if it
right,
does, this is what we do.
Right. So was that just the, was it just that one protest that you did, or do you had other actions then in Nulu?
We just did that.
Okay, that was just the one time
specifically. That was just the one time, but we have continued to fight in different ways around certain businesses in Nulu. We have been able to be at the table talking to business owners. Some of them have signed on to the demands. And that's kind of how it's been happening now. Now it's that we had an action, we gave you all demands, what are you going to do with it? And then we react.
And so can you talk about the outcome of it? I mean, I know it's, there's been a lot of things.
So the outcome has been more. Yeah, the outcome has been a lot. So, like, there are some business owners that are like, hey, like, you all are mean. You're being bullies. You're demanding things of us. How dare you, right? Well, we don't really care about that because, you know, again, is this really bullying by telling you to care about Black life beyond just saying Black Lives Matter? Is that bullying? Or is that you being held accountable and you're not used to Black women holding you accountable? You're used to being able to tell Black women what to do. People are not used to Black women standing up for themselves. So when we do finally stand up of ourselves, they get to say, oh my God, you're being aggressive. Oh my God, you're bullying me. Oh my God, I'm afraid. You're not used to this. Because for you, my freedom looks like, for you, my specific freedom looks like, you know what I'm saying? I don't know. It looks like inferiority to you. You feel like if I get free, you are now inferior. And you don't want that. So you don't want me to be free. So, but beyond that, we've been able to talk to business owners, have roundtable discussions with some of the main people who were involved. We've started boycotting a few, specifically Revelry Boutique, because somebody at Revelry Boutique called the police on protesters, and then they lied and said that they didn't call the police on us. They not only did they, like, we had already knew that they called the police, so we had made that statement like, hey, someone at Revelry called the police, and then they were like, no, we didn't.
Yeah,
you all are lying. I can't believe that you all are doing that. And then as a result of that, they made people, the business owner at Revelry sent people to make death threats on a Black trans woman, got people to write in this person's inbox, even, you know, placed attacks, but, you know, talked about attacking the person's mama. And that's because that person holds a lot of control, right? The owner of Revelry, she holds a lot of control and a whole lot of privilege and access to things.
Yeah.
And people were believing her. People believed that she was telling the truth. And how dare we Black people lie on her? How dare we lie on her? And then we got access to the phone
To the 911 call. Yeah.
The police call. We got access to it.
So they called when you were doing the action.
And they did.
Wow.
They called four times.
Yeah.
So then we called them out with the video. And I don't know if you saw the video. But it's on my Instagram. But the video verbatim says, I'm a security guard at Revelry. And the person who is the security guard at Revelry is her
father-in-law.
Her father-in-law.
Yeah.
And her husband also called.
Wow.
And you mean to tell me you didn't know your husband called the police on us? And she was going really hard on us. And then when we put out something, she said she was out of town. And it's like, well, if you were out of town, then why did you even fight that hard to for something you weren't even there for? You didn't even know. And then your husband, you just now, so she basically
put
her husband under the bus. Said that, he called, but he just told me. I didn't learn that until later.
Yeah.
And we're dealing with it as a couple. That's some of the backlash that we've received, but we've also received many good things. People who understand what we're doing, understand why this is important. But then there's also been some backpedaling on some of the work that we've done, and then other people have been able to intercept and and do things that are counterproductive to what we started in the first place. So they decided to create a diversity council, which we are not in agreement with under any circumstance, because we were not at the table for that, even though all of it was influenced by the work that we did, by our demands. They didn't invite us to the table. They didn't ask us about this. They decided to take another Black person who they can Uncle Tom, and they decided to let that person lead it with our demands.
And how do you, I know that this is sort of in some ways this is an obvious question, but how do you see what you are doing? I just want to give you a chance to clarify. How do you see the intersection between the action at Nulu and the broader movement for justice?
So I want to be very clear about the fact that I am an abolitionist, right? I want to abolish the system. I don't want to reform it. I don't want it to, I don't want to do any of that. I want to abolish the system, right? And that starts with defunding the system. And that starts with defunding organizations and businesses that fund the police in the first place, right? That starts with understanding who the key investors are in the city and who makes the money and who has the ties to certain things. All of this is about generational wealth. All of this is about how do Black people get, how do we seek and how do we get full freedom, full liberation. Like I'm for Black liberation in all spectrums, right? That means making sure that people have housing, and a lot of the key investors in Nulu have gentrified a lot of public housing, or housing where poor people live or Black people live. It's about making sure that Black people have ownership to their businesses. A lot of people, there's not that many Black businesses in Nulu. There's maybe one or two Black businesses in Nulu, and one of those businesses are cold Black owned. Again, that's where Nulu comes in. It's about making sure that we have agency to buy homes and own our homes and not just pay rent in our homes. A lot of business owners and key investors in Nulu, they are buying up homes in the West End where majority of Black people live. And for that reason, we want to go for them. We want to come for them, because you shouldn't be buying up a home for $20 in the West End for you to be able to afford $100 in repairs to sell it for $250,000. That raises the property value in our neighborhoods without people having money.
Well, we're getting close to the end, so I wanted to give you, I wanted to talk a little bit about, you talked about Black trans lives. And I wanted to see if you could talk a little bit more about that and how, you know, how you've been able to include their voices in the movement and some of the struggles with that. Because you talked about some of
that. I'm going to speak a little briefly about that, because I like to keep those things for Black trans people and Black trans women specifically to answer, because I don't want to be the voice for them under any circumstance. But what I try to do in my personal life and what I try to project in my trainings and the spaces that I share is for other cisgender people to make sure that all people are at the table and not necessarily focus on people's identities, but know that that people, and they happen to have, they happen to be transgender, they happen to be a woman, or they happen to be queer, and they still offer up things into these spaces. So don't think of it as this Black trans thought, but just as a person who has a thought, who can bring something to the table, making sure that people understand that everyone has a seat at the table and that all voices are validated. With Change Today, Change Tomorrow, we have created a Black trans fund, which basically means that if you are Black and you are trans, gender non-conforming, or gender non-binary, we basically are giving people up to $300 in allocated funds. I mean, $300 in unrestricted funds And they can apply for it on change-today.org if you are Black and trans, gender nonconforming, or gender non-binary. And that's kind of some of what we are doing as just cisgender people. I am a lesbian, but I am still cisgender. So I know that there's privileges attached to that. So I make sure that people understand that and people know that we do not move with, while silencing Black trans women and Black trans people or Black non-binary people. We do not move and navigate without including those voices. And so if anyone comes into my space, they know that this is an
interesting. Have you seen this, the protest as an opportunity to really address LGBTQ issues?
I address it every single training that I have. I make sure that people know that it exists with any action that I have. Anytime I speak, I make sure that people know exactly my background. I'm a Black, queer, lesbian person and woman, and I'm making sure that all voices are
But to kind of wrap up, what is your sort of perspective on some things that have been happening in these? I know we don't have much time, but you know, with the we have obviously the city had this settlement with Breonna Taylor's family, and then there was the AG who came out with the with not prosecuting the police officers. So you know, how do you what was sort of your reaction to that? What do you see sort of being the next things to work on?
I have no comment on the mama receiving the money. Honestly, her mama is deserving of way more than that. It doesn't even matter how much money she'll be able to get. It doesn't matter. Her child is not coming back. So, you know, sue this family. I mean, sue this city for everything they own, for all I care, right? Because that's not ever going to fill that void. It doesn't even matter. Like, you'll be able to afford things. You'll be able to get things that you need. But essentially, give the city a run for everything that they own, you know? So I'm not bothered by that under any circumstance. Do with that what you want. She doesn't owe anybody any money. She doesn't owe anybody anything. But as far as like what we do moving forward after this is we mobilize and we organize even stronger. We be more strategic. We learn. We teach each other. We hold political conversations. We talk about political education. Yeah. We bring each other in. We heal
together. And where do you see things after 2020? Are you hopeful? And you started off talking about hope. I don't know if you're something you're.
Yeah, like hope is so important. People, we gotta teach people what change has the ability to look like. Change for a lot of people. People think that it's like this on and off switch where, okay, first this was happening, now this is happening tomorrow. And it doesn't happen that way. Change is happening every single day. I'm able to have conversations with people who I never had conversations with. I'm able to be in spaces with people who I never would have had that space to be in. We're having conversations and talking about things that we never were talking about before.
That's true.
That's important.
That's
important. Yeah. And that is change. We are making people uncomfortable and interrupting spaces that never had to think about these things.
I love it.
That is change.
Anything else that you'd like to add? Anything maybe we didn't get a chance to talk about? Or okay. All right. So I'll send you an email. There's a form that they ask you to sign so that we can give them the recording. And then maybe you can send me a photograph for the publication. And I'll keep you updated on where we're at with that.
Okay, yeah, no problem.
Okay, thank you so much, and have a great day, Talisha. Okay.
You too.